From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Negotiations continue in Washington over the next pandemic relief bill. There appear to be not just major differences between Democrats and Republicans, but also disunity in the Republican Party on their proposal. Meanwhile, emergency unemployment benefits expire on Friday. Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland joins us now. Senator, welcome.
Jeremy, good to be with you.
Well, before we get to the pandemic relief, I've got to ask you about some big news this morning. The president says he plans to withdraw nearly 12,000 troops from Germany, a move that our allies are concerned will weaken NATO. Trump has accused Germany of not spending enough on shared defense. What's your reaction to that?
This is a terrible move. It undermines the credibility of the NATO alliance. It calls into question our commitment to our NATO allies. This is exactly the thing that will cause Vladimir Putin to pop his champagne or vodka bottles in Moscow, and it's the exact wrong direction to go.
Do you have any sense of why the president is doing it?
Well, he has said from the beginning that he questions NATO and the utility of the alliance, and sadly, we're now seeing that sentiment put into action. Some of his supporters keep trying to say, well, he didn't really mean it. He really does support NATO. But now we're seeing actions that indicate that he is not a strong supporter of the alliance, and he is taking actions that essentially bring smiles to the faces of our adversaries and great fear to our allies.
Let me ask you about the relief bill. How much are you willing to compromise, and other Democrats willing to compromise with Republicans, to get something passed before some of these benefits run out? One of the critical issues is whether there should be an extra $600 of weekly unemployment benefits, which is what Democrats want, or Republicans have been proposing $200 extra.
Well, the loss of $400 per week for struggling families is going to be devastating. I mean, their bills have not stopped. Their rent payments have not stopped. Their mortgage payments are not on hold. So we need to maintain a large level of support. Are we willing to sit down and talk with our Republican colleagues about this? Of course. But we've been waiting 2 months and 2 weeks now since the House passed its bill. And now we get this proposal from Republicans that's totally inadequate, does not extend the eviction moratorium, has not a penny for state and local government, does not create additional funds for the nutrition programs. So this is totally inadequate to the needs that are out there in the country.
Do you need all those things in a bill in order to support it?
Well, we need the basic elements of a proposal of a response that meets the needs of the people who are hurting most around the country. And we need to address both the health aspects and make sure that we have adequate testing, which the Republican bill does not provide for because they don't have a mechanism to increase the supply. And we need a robust safety net for people who are hurting through no fault of their own. And the Republican bill provides neither.
Republicans have been focused on liability protection for businesses, basically making it so that you can't sue a business if you get COVID there. Is that something that you could get behind?
No, it's outrageous. On the one hand, they're pushing people back to work, and we want people to go to work to the extent that it's safe. And what Republicans are saying is that employers, businesses have no obligation to ensure a safe work environment, and that they don't want to be held responsible or accountable if people come back to their work site and get sick because of the negligence of the company. What we really need to do is establish clear safety standards for the workplace, and then we can talk about, you know, whether or not businesses that meet those standards, whether there's a rebuttable presumption that they impose the protections required or not. So, but what the McConnell bill does is essentially say to businesses, you can go ahead, be negligent, you know, don't provide safety measures in the workplace, and, you know, we're going to look the other way. You cannot be held accountable. That's outrageous.
It sounds like you're pretty far apart, though, at this point. This doesn't sound like something that's going to be resolved in just a couple of days.
Well, first of all, the Republican caucus is split, and they're far apart among themselves. The number I've heard is half the members of the Senate Republican caucus don't want to do anything, which just means it's all the more important for the Trump administration and Mitch McConnell to work with Democrats to get this done. We have been waiting 2 months and 2 weeks since the House passed the HEROES Act, and all we get is this bill that is totally inadequate to meeting the needs and actually does harm by putting workers and consumers at greater risk. And at the same time, I should point out their bill, they want to reinstate the tax break for three martini lunches. They have a proposal, which they call emergency, to get over $1 billion for the FBI headquarters at its current location, which would be great for the president because it would avoid any competition in the future to his hotel. It's really outrageous what they put forward.
So would you support a short-term extension of these extended unemployment benefits if no deal can be reached in the next couple of days?
Well, we want to use this opportunity to sit down with our Republican colleagues and do what we've been trying to get them to do for 2 months and 2 weeks, which is come up with a continuation of a safety net for the American people.
That is Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
There's a resolution apparently in sight to weeks of nightly confrontations between protesters and federal agents at a federal courthouse in Portland, Oregon. This morning, Oregon Governor Kate Brown announced that federal agents will begin to withdraw. With us now is Maxine Bernstein. She covers federal courts and law enforcement for the Oregonian. And Maxine, what can you tell us about this resolution?
So Oregon's Governor Kate Brown announced this morning that federal officers are going to start pulling out of Portland tomorrow on Thursday in a phased approach, and instead Oregon State Police troopers will move in to back up the Federal Protective Service officers to safeguard the federal courthouse in downtown Portland.
Okay, so troopers will replace those federal agents. Just this morning, President Trump called protesters anarchists and said agents aren't leaving Portland until the city is secured. Let's listen to that.
So either they clean out Portland, the governor and the mayor, who are weak, either they clean out Portland or we're going in to do a storm. Okay, thank you very much.
Maxine, how has the presence of these agents at the courthouse escalated the situation over the past few weeks? And will it be different with having the troopers there versus the agents?
Yeah, the federal officers, many of whom were clad in camouflage fatigues, triggered a huge escalation in the number of demonstrators who would show up and come out in the streets. And the focus of the demonstrations turned from Black Lives Matter to demands that the feds go home. And oftentimes the large demonstrations during the day would devolve at night into violent clashes between some in the some outside the courthouse who were just intent on driving the federal officers out of the city and would be throwing fireworks and other objects at officers trying to cut down or tear down the fence outside, and resulted almost predictably with federal officers responding with tear gas and firing impact munitions into the crowd that led to numerous injuries of peaceful demonstrators, of journalists, of legal observers, of many in the crowd, and it sparked multiple civil suits against the federal law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, we're just hearing more about federal agents withdrawing. But what's being said about the administration's decision to then send in troops?
Well, Oregon's governor, the Portland's mayor, they all rejected and called on the Trump administration to keep the federal officers out of the city. And despite their pleas, that the officers arrived, and there were about 114 here that were based at the courthouse, and the federal Trump administration yeah. argued that the officers were here to defend the federal courthouse, but there were questions about whether the officers exceeded their authority under the Homeland Security Act, because there were times when the officers left the property of the courthouse and would push back demonstrators blocks from the building and would make arrests outside blocks yeah. away.
So there's lots of developments here. And as you laid out for us, what feels like a very much a chaotic scene, you being both inside of the courthouse and outside of the courthouse. Of course, this is a developing story that we will continue to follow. Maxine Bernstein covers federal courts and law enforcement for the Oregonian newspaper. Thank you, Maxine.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
What tribes do you belong to? For British Member of Parliament David Lammy, there are many. He has Guyanese roots. He feels connected to the United Kingdom and, as a politician, to his party, the Labour Party. But in a new book, he says sorting ourselves into groups can also be problematic. It's called Tribes, How Our Need to Belong Can Make or Break Society. And David Lammy joins us once again from London. Welcome back. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Really pleased.
Well, and let's go to where you begin this book, which is that you got your DNA tested. What did you find out?
Well, my parents are from Guyana, at the top of South America, the bottom of the Caribbean. I've always known, I guess, that my descendants were enslaved people who came from Africa across the Middle Passage, brought by probably the Dutch, but maybe the English, to Guyana. It was a Dutch colony at one point. I took this DNA test, and what it told me was that on my father's paternal line, I went back to Bantu South Africans and Angolans. And on my mother's maternal line, I went back to the Temne tribe in Sierra Leone and Tuaregs in the country of Niger. And I've got a little bit of Scottish in me.
Well, and you said that it gave you something that you had longed for, which was a genetic sense of self. And I wonder, why did you want that so much?
Well, I think, like a lot of African Americans who are listening, like a lot of folk who stem from the Caribbean or Latin America, we are hybrid people. And if you are the descendant of enslaved people, you know at a certain point there was a dramatic, traumatic interruption in which your descendants lost their language, lost their culture, lost who they were. And because most of those slaves were captured as really sort of teenagers, that chain and that link back to wherever you came from in Africa was broken. So there is a longing and a belonging that isn't quite there. So it's an intriguing process to take your DNA test if you are the descendant of enslaved people. And that's the journey I went on. And it took me to Niger. And I write about that experience of going to a black Muslim country, spending time with these wonderful black Muslim people, praying with them, eating with them, sitting with them. And I felt a deep connection that I said to them at the end of this ceremony they did for me, that, you know, I will stand up in the House of Commons in London and I will stand taller than I was before I came here, because I have a greater sense of who I am as I stand in that historic place, speaking truth to power.
Well, and how does that connection that you had there compare to the connection you have to Britain, compare to the connection that you have, let's say, to your neighborhood in London, or to the Labour Party, which is the party that you are a member of? How do those tribes compare?
I thought it was important, if I was going to write a book about the new tribalism that is gripping our world, that is making politics deeply partisan, that is meaning that people fall into these rabbit holes and echo chambers, that I needed to explore my tribe. So you're absolutely right. Yes, I'm the descendant of Guyanese people who were formerly Africans. But in the end, I grew up in London and in the city of Peterborough in Middle England. I was very fortunate to go to Harvard Law School. I am a black middle-class man here in the UK. And in getting to what I wanted to write about, it was important to explore my tribes. And I explore those tribes in the book. I talk about what it meant to go to a boarding school in Peterborough. I go back to that city. I speak to people who have strong views about immigration, people who took me into their homes, who fed me, who loved me because I had friends from that city at school who lived in the city, but nevertheless have very different views to me. These are folk in the UK that would be like folk you would meet in the Rust Belt in America that would have voted for Donald Trump and feel very strongly against folk in the city and in Washington. And I spent time with those people and talked about my affection for those folk, even though we had very different views, and how I belong in that city and how that makes me English, and how there are things about me, despite being a black Briton, you know, things that are quintessentially English. My humour, the food I eat and like, mm-hmm. the things that I grew up about with, and indeed my party, the Labour Party, and the traditions that the Labour Party has as a senior British politician. So I explore all of that, and I try to write about these things in a way that's not judgmental, in a way that's trying to listen and to hear and to bridge divides. You know, I'm married to a white middle-class woman. My children are biracial, and I have a large white extended family, some of whom do not hold the same political views as myself. So that's the I'm trying to write in a generous way to arrive at a point where I explore the divisions that we're all living with that seem so powerfully strong in wider society at this time.
Well, and when you talk about some of those things, you see the sort of charming side of tribes. But you also talk a lot in this book about where tribalism becomes a real problem. And I want to go through a couple of those. And let's start with politics, because in your country and in this country, there are some politicians who march in such lockstep with their party that it does seem like, you know, the party is more important than even their own views on things. How did politics become so tribal?
You're absolutely right. We're living in an age of populism. We're living in an age where there has been a deliberate attempt in parts of our politics, in the UK, on the extreme left and the extreme right of politics, to deliberately divide us, to deliberately take people's eye off the ball. The issue of our times is not artificial intelligence or automation or deep inequality across society. The issue of our time is building a Mexican wall, is fighting mm-hmm. with the European Union, is Imran, who just arrived from a Muslim country and wants to take your job. And that stuff is stoked on social media. And indeed, there are even external countries, Russia very famously, manipulating this stuff. Those are the times we're in, deliberately playing to the worst instincts of tribalism mm-hmm. and whole swathes of the population happy to sort of deep dive into this. And it doesn't end in a great place. I mean, you know, the challenges of our time, climate change, a global pandemic, actually require global cooperation. Right. That's the point.
Well, and you talk about tribalism and Islamist extremism in a conversation that you had with a taxi driver who told you about his son who had been radicalized by ISIS. Tell us about that and what you learned from that interaction.
Well, it was a trip that I was in a sort of taxi on the way to Heathrow Airport. And it was just a painful story because, of course, in examining how this had happened, we touched on the loneliness of these young men mm-hmm. sitting in their bedrooms, the internet, what was going on at the local mosque, the ways in which these young men were seduced into this violent extremism that had now had catastrophic effect on their family. And I linked that theme of loneliness to another individual who sent me and five other members of parliament here in the UK a serious death threat. And I went to his trial. And despite the fact that this man had called me the N-word, had hurled abuse, had threatened to kill me, sitting in his trial, I realized that this individual was kind of pathetic and was lonely. He was a lonely, mean racist, able to sort of exact revenge again, be seduced into extremism. This is far-right extremism, the sort of extremism that killed my fellow MP and colleague Joe Cox a few years ago here in the UK. And these same themes coming up that I thought it was important to explore.
People are lonely and they need to belong.
We have an innate need to belong. And I think the other thing that I explore in the book is, of course, the theme of our times, identity politics. Here I am as a black member of parliament, of course, called to defend and speak up for minority black communities here in the UK and globally, to be in solidarity with movements like Black Lives Matter. But at the same time, I also recognize that if race is the start and end of every conversation, then we run the risk of not finding common purpose and a shared humanity.
That is David Lammy, a member of the Labour Party in the British Parliament. His new book is called Tribes: Our Need to Belong Can Make or Break Society. We'll have more of our conversation tomorrow. Today, Boeing reported a $2.4 billion quarterly loss and announced it would slow production of new aircraft, another sign of how the pandemic is devastating the airline industry. JetBlue also reported a huge loss this week and said revenue in the next quarter is expected to drop by 80% as air travel demand plummets. Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. And Seth, let's start with Boeing, which was already in financial trouble before the pandemic, and second quarter earnings are worse than expected. What does that tell you? Is it more of a long-term concern for the industry to see a problem like that at Boeing than at an airline?
That's exactly what it is, Jeremy. You know, if you're looking for good news, and how could there be any good news about a $2.4 billion loss, as you said, well, that's a smaller loss than Boeing reported a year earlier, nearly $3 billion for the same quarter last year. The difference, though, Jeremy, is that back then it seemed like sort of a one-time thing. That was right after the second MAX crash, the first full quarter after that. And Boeing sort of thought, hey, we'll get through this. I mean, setting aside the obviously the human toll there, but in financial terms, it would get through that, go back to selling and delivering airplanes. Now it's dealing with something very different, a world that doesn't really want nearly as many airplanes as Boeing and its competitor Airbus thought they would want. If you're looking for actual good news, Boeing's defense business, at least the other side of the company, relatively stable.
And what about JetBlue and its loss reported? How does that weak performance compare to the other airlines? Are they all kind of in the same boat at this point?
Yeah, I've never seen numbers like these before, Jeremy. So JetBlue reported a negative 191% operating loss margin. I mean, for perspective, Jeremy, usually like a negative double-digit margin, you see an airline with negative 12% somewhere in the world, that's terrible. That negative 191% was actually better by that measure than most other U.S. airlines, which were in excess of negative 200%. So this is just off the charts compared to any other environment. JetBlue, fortunate at least to be a mostly domestic airline, unlike Delta, United, and American to a lesser degree, which, of course, can't fly to many of the places around the world where they like to fly.
When it comes to Delta, it is updating its policy for face coverings, what it allows and what it demands and what it doesn't allow. What's the latest there?
Yeah, Delta has taken the lead in many of these regards. JetBlue actually was the first to mandate masks, but Delta now enforcing its mandate very strictly. It actually, Jeremy, you know, the stereotype about the parent telling a child in a car, hey, I'll turn this car around if you don't behave. Delta turned a plane around the other day, not one that had taken off, but at Detroit, back to the gate, made a couple passengers get off because they refused to wear masks, according to local news reports there. Also now banning masks with exhaust valves. You've seen these masks with the little valves. They say, look, that's not about preventing the spread of this virus. That's for industrial reasons. So you can't wear those either on Delta.
Huh. And what about Amtrak? They're cracking down when it comes to face masks too.
They are basically saying no exceptions. If you're in a regular seat, you have to have your mask on pretty much the whole time. So the only exception is if you're in an individual room, then you can take your mask off. But other than that, they're going to ask you to get off the train, perhaps ban you from traveling, just as back to Delta. They've banned more than 100 people from flying Delta because they've refused to wear masks.
We'll see if they take that kind of action when it comes to enforcing the quiet car. Seth Kaplan here, my transportation analyst. Thank you.
You got it, Jeremy.
Back in 2007, Kanye West was at the top of his game.
And a multi-platinum titan artist. All right, y'all ready? Kanye West, bring him out.
West was a well-respected producer and rapper. His third studio album, Graduation, debuted at number one on the Billboard charts. And it was around that time that West started declaring himself the voice of a generation. Music journalist Naima Cochran remembers West definitely being a major cultural influence.
I remember people enjoying Kanye as a solo artist. His production, which we were already familiar with, his cadence, his kind of tongue-in-cheek snark and sarcasm. It was a refreshing kind of energy and something that wasn't all the way New York, but also wasn't all the way down south and had its own unique flavor to it.
And she says it was perceived that his sometimes outlandish comments and behaviors were part of the shtick.
It felt then, which is very different now, like Kanye was kind of in on the Kanye's joke, which was actually part of the persona.
In 2018, West revealed he has a mental illness, and some mental health advocates are now pushing for the media to re-examine the way we cover West's actions, his comments about slavery, our current president, and his running for president. Bossy Igbe is one of those advocates. She's also the author of I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying, where she writes about her own bipolar diagnosis. Bossy started our conversation by sharing with me how her own experience of being hospitalized has impacted her view of Kanye West.
It's difficult to watch Kanye West. I think that every single time that he's come out and done something that's caused this uproar in the news or in conversation, I've been able to recognize that it's a manic episode almost immediately. The same way that, you know, someone who has experienced, let's say, diabetic shock or, you know, another sort of invisible illness, they can recognize it in somebody else. So I always feel immediately compassionate. And then on top of that, when people have these conversations about him, it does upset me because what we're saying is that we only care about mental health when we like the person who's experiencing it, right? And we're able to, and when I say we, I mean as a society, we're able to speak about him in ways that are so unkind and lack grace and lack empathy and justify it because he's saying things we don't like. What I've been saying lately is that Kanye is never going to hear you. He's not going to log onto his Twitter and see you tweeting him and be like, oh, they make a good point. The person who sees you, your neighbor who's experiencing a mental health crisis sees you, your sibling who has not been able to tell you or find the language to tell you sees you. So all these people that you do have an impact on are seeing the way that you treat this person, and they're either going to hide from you, they're going to dismiss their own feelings, or they're going to know that they're going to feel as though they're not worthy of empathy and kindness and grace and forgiveness.
This is so powerful because what you're saying is how we outwardly talk about people of influence like Kanye West really speaks to then how people in our lives may interpret how we feel about them if they're dealing with mental illness. But Bassi, I want to ask you, how can we also hold people with mental illness accountable in an ethical way? How can we differentiate between someone's mental illness and their sometimes hurtful actions? Kanye West, for instance, has been called a misogynist. He's been called attention seeking.
Well, here's the problem with that is that I'm not saying that he's not a misogynist. I'm not saying that he's not an attention seeker. I'm not saying that he isn't saying harmful things. I'm saying that it's heightened by his illness. I'm saying that you cannot hold, I'll go back to using the diabetic as an example. If someone is experiencing diabetic shock and needs insulin, before you help them, do you say, well, first of all, before I help you, I want to say that I do not agree with what you said about A, B, C, and D. No, you just help. You just hope that they're okay. You know, holding him accountable is something that people say often, and I don't really know what that means, because if you say and you acknowledge something that I say, which is it's not an excuse. Mental illness is not an excuse, but it is a reason. It is a reason, and it has to be contextualized. It has to be framed so that people understand that the way that one behaves is the literal definition of what a mental illness is. It does affect the way that he behaves. It does affect the way that he thinks. And this is the part that I think that is unsaid. Someone who has access to the best medical treatment in the world, who is not using it, there is a resentment that shows up. How can you have all this money and all this fame and all this celebrity and all this access and still have the nerve to be crazy? That's what's being said that no one is really talking about, because there's no space for accountability when the person isn't hearing you. And I mean that literally, not hearing you because he's not present, but also not hearing you because the illness is a block between whatever sense you're trying to make and whatever you're trying to communicate to them.
Bassi, how would you like the media to cover Kanye right now? What conversations do you want to hear?
You can't ignore him because he's you know, too big, more or less. But because he's been so open about his diagnosis, when you speak about him, you have to also have a simultaneous conversation about mental health, bipolar disorder. Doctors should be spoken to about the symptoms that are listed, because I've also realized over these last couple of weeks that people don't know what the symptoms are. Using myself as an example, I don't have the access or the resource or the personality to, you know, put together a rally in South Carolina. But my version of that is tweeting for hours and days on end nonstop. My paranoia doesn't show up in these right-wing conspiracies, because that's not my personality to start with. But it does show up in calling someone hundreds of times because I'm worried that they're mad at me. You know, it shows up in different ways. And I think that we tend to get really stuck in these definitions that allow us to decide whether or not somebody is worthy of empathy.
So in thinking about all that you said, empathy, yes, we should all have it. But really, you want all of us to be open to having real conversations with the people in our lives who may be dealing with mental illness. And Kanye West just represents that for us.
Yeah, he's the most visible person with a bipolar diagnosis in the world right now. So he represents more than just someone that people are projecting onto. He represents all of us.
When you were first diagnosed with bipolar, you say you were looking for people to talk with who had a similar experience, especially in the Black community, but you had a hard time finding those connections. It's part of why you believe visibility matters.
Yeah. I have a level of privilege that allows me to be vulnerable. And I know that not a lot of people have that. So what I can do is be transparent and vulnerable so that someone can either A, say, this is a mirror. This is someone that feels the way or seems to feel the way that I feel, or it's a window. This is someone that looks like what my sibling or parent or coworker that I don't like, or the guy that cut me off in traffic or whatever. this is a window into what they possibly could be going through. It's not exact, but it's always for me about opening up the chambers of empathy that are not predicated on pity. But if we're trying to have really honest conversations about mental illness and the way that it affects the Black community, especially because we are pathologized and criminalized in ways that other people are not, we have to keep having these conversations and put them in context of the bigger picture, as opposed to these very personal projections that I just don't think are fair to him, but also not fair to us as people.
Bassey Igbe is a Nigerian-American author of I'm Telling the Truth, But I'm Lying, and a mental health advocate. I really appreciate this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you or someone you know is dealing with a mental health crisis and want to talk, you can call the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Their helpline is 1-800-950-6264.
The Washington, D.C. football team that just got rid of its name, which was widely considered to be racist and offensive to Native Americans, is just one of many sports teams dealing with that issue. But as residents of my hometown of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois know well, retiring a name and an image doesn't always mean that it will disappear in the long haul. Lee Gaines of Illinois Newsroom reports.
On February 21st, 2007, thousands of people watched as a white man dressed in Native American regalia danced, high-kicked, and jumped across the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign basketball court while a marching band played. He wore a feather headdress and blue, orange, and white face paint. As the performance came to a close, the crowd cheered, and some had tears streaming down their faces.
Chief Olanowek walks off the court for the last time at the University of Illinois.
The event was meant to be the end of a tradition which dates back to 1926, and it came after decades of calls for the university to retire the race-based mascot. But some traditions don't die easy. Today, 13 years after Chief Olanowek was officially retired by the U of I, the symbol endures. People dressed like the mascot still pop up at games. There are Facebook groups with thousands of members calling on the university to reinstate the mascot. And merchandise with Chief Olanowek's image is still sold.
I'm not certain that the university can move beyond Chief Olanowek anytime soon.
That's Matthew Sakayastua Gilbert. He spent 13 years as an American Indian Studies professor at the U of I and now heads the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona. Sakayastua Gilbert saw Chief Olanowek perform at a football game in 2006. A woman next to him asked what he did. Then she asked if he was an Indian.
And I said, I'm Hopi Indian from northeastern Arizona. And I always remember what she told me. She says, why don't you go down there and be the chief? And, you know, and then everything will be okay.
By that time, the chief had become an extremely divisive issue on campus. The university was fighting to retain the mascot while the NCAA was pressuring institutions to get rid of racist Native American imagery. Debbie Reese is a Pueblo Indian who taught at the university at that time. She's an expert in Native American imagery and children's literature. Reese remembers protesting the chief outside football and basketball games.
We would go to silent protests at the games where you do put yourself at risk of being spat upon, of being yelled at, of being cursed at. Those were always very uncomfortable things, but we felt important, so we did them.
Reese says the chief is a misrepresentation of Native people.
The honoring that people say they do with mascots like this is not honoring. It's denigrating, it's demeaning, and it's an insult.
The intent of Chief Olanowek was to hold a culture in reverence and encouraging people to learn about it.
Dan Maloney was the last person to officially portray Chief Olanowek on that University of Illinois basketball court back in February 2007. He was a graduate student then. Maloney says the reverence Chief fans have for the character is one of the reasons it has endured long past its official retirement.
when that's removed, especially when it's such a strong source of inspiration to many, many people over many, many years, it can be tough to move forward.
And many who oppose the chief say the university is to blame for its continued presence because nothing ever replaced it.
It's basically, for a lot of people, still the mascot of the University of Illinois.
That's Vikram Sardana. He graduated from the U of I last year, and he served on a commission intended to heal the Chief Illiniwek divide. Sardana says the university should have created a new mascot years ago.
And I think that the lesson people should take from this is that not acting can make a problem worse than it needs to be, that at some point you have to rip the bandage off.
A spokesperson for the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign says that administrators are working on a plan to move the campus forward, which will include a process to establish new traditions. But Matthew Sakaya-Stua-Gilbert is skeptical that a new mascot can end the years-long controversy. And he says that's because of all the alumni and fans who still cling to Chief Illiniwek.
I think this will continue to be a controversy. This will continue to be a burden on the university, especially the native students who have to deal with this on a daily basis who are enrolled at the university.
Sakaya-Stua-Gilbert says time may prove to be the ultimate solution to the Chief Illiniwek problem. As years go by, there will be fewer people who remember when a white man in a feather headdress and face paint danced across the university's basketball courts and football fields at halftime. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Gaines.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.